Chapter 35. He had only gone by to watch. He loved to track the shadows stretching over pulled shades, to see which lights stayed on and which went out, to know what time Kit went to bed and what Charlie did after her mother was down. Sandy had invited herself, armed this time, with the bribe that she could give him a copy of Kit's key if he let her come. He hadn't known they would be gone, lights out, driveway empty. Sandy found the spare key taped slyly under the top step and let him in the back door. As he went in, a bramble snagged the skin of his tricep and broke off, embedded like a tick. Just being in this house, with her smells all around him, turned him on. He hustled Sandy toward the kitchen sink, lifted her up, and plunged her mouth with his tongue. Strawberry gum. Sweet junk sex, this one. Plentiful and cheap. A bottomless soda. She gripped his hips tightly with her knees, locked her ankles behind him.
"When do you think she's coming back?"
she whispered, fingering his hair.
"Could be any time."
"What if she catches us?"
she said, not cautious, but thrilled.
"What'll we do?"
"That's why I need you on the lookout," he said, and kissed each eye, steered her out the door, and patted her on her broad, flat behind.
She stalked back to the car in pouty obedience. He was tiring of her soft petulance, her scent, the chemical tell of her imitation perfume and how it followed him around, the way she rouged her cheeks to carve out cheekbones where there were none. She only made him crave Kit more. Manny wanted to slip Kit on like skin, feel what she felt, pat around in her footsteps. He had been so dutiful, so restrained with her, not letting his hunger show. He had veered off track with the horse, and the virulence of his jealousy had surprised him. But it was a necessary detour, a purge. Now that he was here, in her private place, his obsession was baited, and he was salivating. He had never been able to penetrate her, see her guts the way he wanted. They were the same stuff, but she always kept part of herself out of reach. Here, perhaps, he could stick his hand in and take it. He needed a talisman. More than that, he craved a sign. Something to let him know Kit still needed him. With Sandy perched at the car window like a spaniel, he ventured upstairs and found, at the end of the hall, Kit's room. He walked toward it deliberately, as if approaching a holy place. When he felt clods of dirt crunch underfoot, he knew he was treading on the same soil Kit had. A fussy lampshade on the bedside table, old lady wallpaper, and an antique brass bed. The smell of dust, old paper, cedar sap. None of it was hers. And yet, to have let it be, after all this time, to have lived tracelessly, was classic Kit.
"I know you," he said with such fondness.
He opened the closet door, rummaged through a few things stowed in a box on the floor. Nothing of use to him. Some crude drawings and a framed photo, her dead aunt's will, a recipe for garlic bread. He knelt and nestled his head in the rivulets she'd left in the unmade bed, overwhelmed by feelings both vicious and tender.
"Together or apart, you could never hide from me."
He slid his hands under the mattress as if he could find her there, fingers groping, face pressed into the seam. Why could he have anyone he wanted but her? How could she reject him when he had given her all of him, everything she could need? He had been contrite. He had humbled himself. Didn't she know what that meant to him? He lurched forward, screaming, and pushed the mattress halfway off the bed. Something clattered to the floor. He crouched and tucked his head under the bed. Dust balls and tissues and a shadowy clump. He reached out and held it like a small animal in his hand, brushed off the dust, and held it to the light. It was a trinket, a tiny chandelier made of pink shells. Galveston. She had held on to it all these years. As he gazed at the bauble, which was no more than six strands of pink shells, the shape of conches and the size of pearls, attached to a rack of spokes, which were encrusted in the same shells, he remembered the dare, how she had balked, only briefly, and accepted the challenge. He knew then that he could trust her, that she had saved the souvenir was all the sign he needed. Then he sensed a leering presence in the doorway. He turned to see Sandy, nude and transformed. At her side, she dangled 3 feet of braid like a dead snake, limp and headless. Her once long hair was now choppy and short around her face, like Kit. Without speaking, she went to the dirty clothes on the floor and put on plain underwear, men's jeans, and a work-soiled white t-shirt. She approached Manny and stopped in front of him, a grotesque facsimile of his one true love. In the dim light of the lamp, he saw that she had wiped away her makeup. In her eyes, the mad look of last resort. She tugged him by the belt and punched him across the nose. Something warm and wet trickled over his lip. He tasted blood. Entranced by the brazen move, he lifted her under the thighs and plowed her against the wall. He forced his mouth across her face like he could swallow her whole. She bit at him furiously and yanked his head back, denying him. And he flipped her around, arms pinned at the small of her back. "Face me like a man," she seethed. And even now her voice came out like that of a wild thing, like Kit's. He pulled down the jeans, too tight around her hips, but she took his hands and wrapped them around her neck. "Hurt me," she said. "Break my bones." And she blinked. Her eyes glossed over with tears and dissolved the spell. She whimpered, and all of a sudden Manny saw her as she was, a feeble, sallow waif in masquerade. She kept nothing to herself, left it all in the open, emotionally pornographic. He hated her face, her poor teeth, her fawning regard. Her vulnerability made him ill. The mounting desires and hateful twitch that churned beneath his skin since Kit had left him today, and 14 years ago, and even before Kit, since his mother had favored his faggy brother over him, and taken him to bed and caressed him like her one and only, since his father had tucked his dick between his legs and hunched away, cuckolded by his own son. All of it rained down like many whips at this monster. Hair like Kit, bags for breasts like mother, wilting spine like papa. He wrapped the braid around her neck and pulled it tight. She looked back more directly, searching his eyes for connection. After a minute, when lack of air tripped her instincts, fear overtook her. She thrashed. "Yes," Manny said. "Fight it." He held her by her throat while the rest of her flailed. Soon, she fell limp into resigned, fatal sadness. He tightened the noose, her only vanity, years of her small life wrapped around her neck, punishing her weakness. And as she faded out of this world that had failed her so terribly, even to the end. Her eyebrows furrowed, and her eyes met Manny's with what looked like disdain. Her lips puckered, and with all the strength she had left, she spat. "Good girl," Manny said, and he held her until the last heartbeat. He admired the fierceness she had shown there at the end, albeit too late to save her. And as soon as she was gone, he was overwhelmed by a sense of peace and rightness, even a fondness for this docile creature in his arms. He thanked God for his mercy and for showing him the way. All this time he had squandered his gift on manipulation, charm, libidinous excesses. Cheap, sordid, disposable. Here, now, he had tapped the purest source, the power to take a life. He regarded her now like a miracle. She was warm to touch still, so much so that he wouldn't have believed she was dead, if it weren't for the look on her face. All life had been cast out, the eyes vacant and askew. He pulled the t-shirt she was wearing up and over her face, a partial shroud. Just then, he heard a car pull up and could see from the window that it was police. His heart picked up. Had someone seen him come here? Or maybe had called about the horse, came to ask Kit about it? Manny wasn't armed. He might be able to slip away unnoticed, or hide until they left. Surely the cop wouldn't bust in. Wasn't that kind of town. The cop slammed his car door and stepped into the light of the front porch so Manny could get a look at him. A baby face. A boy with a gun. He had seen him at church once. Nothing special. Too curious to leave, Manny went downstairs and crouched next to the door, listening. The cop marched up the steps and knocked. Three decisive raps. A tedious minute passed. "It's Caleb," the cop called out. "First name basis, are we?" Manny thought with a jealous punch. He peered through one of the tall, curtained windows flanking the door in time to see the guy puff into the hollow of his hand and sniff. He was checking his breath.
"I'm sorry to bother you so late," the cop said. "I hope I didn't spook you. I was headed home for the night and got to thinking."
The words came out mushy, like he'd been drinking.
"I decided," the cop said, and took a breath. "I decided I should check on you. Make sure you're all right after the other night at the Rollin'."
Caleb's voice broke like that of a teenager, and he coughed to clear it. This goofus do-gooder was head over heels. Manny felt bad for him, really. The cop and Sandy were cut from the same cloth. Victims, both.
"Edible things for animals like us."
Manny smothered a laugh with the back of his hand and froze. The cop stopped moving and cocked his ear. Manny scanned the room for weapons. No gun above the door. Maybe there was a knife in the kitchen, or a good heavy pot. But the bitch didn't cook, and there was no counting on anything being where it ought to be. A kitchen chair brought down on the head would have to suffice. Manny stood to the side where the door would open and raised the chair above his head. He'd begun to sweat now, his heart giddy as he waited for the right moment. But the cop didn't bust in, or even bother to look around the house.
"Oh, okay," the cop said. "Yeah, sorry to bother you."
He drooped like a cut flower and slunk away to his car, dejected from the looks of it, ashamed. And then Manny understood. The cop had heard Manny laughing and thought it was Kit. As he carried Sandy out like a bride, Manny hummed his favorite hymn.
There is power, power, wonder working power. In the blood of the Lamb, there is power, power, wonder working power in the precious blood of the Lamb. He contemplated her in a bashful sort of way. After all, she had been his first. Dear Sandy, not fit for this world, not even for a town as humble as this. Meek and mild, shat upon by all. Perhaps he was guilty of abusing her too, but at least he had given her his attention, had filled her heart with the love she felt for him. He could be proud for having shepherded a soul in pain back into the Lord's generous arms. He loaded her remains in the deep trunk of her caprice. It took some doing, as she was a densely packed woman, ever more so now that she was dead. When she was nicely arranged, he shut the trunk and headed back to the house to clean up after himself. He wanted to wipe the last traces of his little peccadillo from the scene. A few loose ends, nothing glaring, but he liked to be tidy. The sound of someone walking over gravel stopped him in his tracks. This was an unpleasant interruption. In the blacks and grays up ahead, he caught sight of the lanky silhouette with Kit's determination and his swagger marching a straight line down the middle of the driveway, a shotgun slung across her back. Then, awestruck, he understood. God had delivered her to him. He had been missing the signs. Now that his eyes were open, it all made sense. It was so clear he felt stupid he hadn't seen it before. The prize was Charlie all along. It must be. Could it be that even Kit's rejection was part of the plan? Kit was never going to take him back. She had a new love, the love he knew all too well, the love of a parent. All this time, his focus had been Kit, but he hadn't wanted to admit how much she had changed, how she had lost her edge, been clipped by small-town comforts, her scent unfresh with stasis. He had a chance to start over with this new child, forge new adventures. He could raise his pup even better than he'd raised Kit because the girl was half him. Unblemished. Superior. Praise God. 20 minutes into her walk to the Big Sky Motel, Charlie passed her home and saw a set of headlights pointed away from the house. She thought, at first, that her mother must have woken up and beaten her there. But why hadn't Kit passed her on the way? She turned down the rough road, crossed the rusting cattle guard on tiptoe. The hens burbled in their hutch as she passed by. Now that she was closer, she could see the lights were low, not a truck, but a car. Her chest tightened up, and she stopped to locate whoever was waiting at her house. She reached around to flip the safety off her mother's gun. She was trying to make out the car's color through the glare when a man appeared and clucked his tongue.
Your mama let you run around at all hours of the morning?
It was Manny. She grinned and laughed a little, feeling mighty glad to see him. Her luck, it seemed, was turning.
You've scared the crap out of me, she said, letting out a nervous laugh. What are you doing here so early?
She thought Manny looked irritated at first, though it was hard to tell in the dark, but when he spoke, she could hear she'd been mistaken.
You ever get a wrong feeling? He said. Like something's going south? I woke up an hour ago and couldn't shake the worry that something had happened to you and your mama. When I knocked and you didn't answer, well, I admit I feared the worst.
She thought it strange he'd go to all that trouble on a feeling. But then maybe that was what family did for each other. How would she know?
Well, what are you doing wandering around in the dark?
Now that he was here in front of her,
Her plan seemed flimsy and childish.
It's okay, sweetheart. I won't tell,
he said, nice as can be, enough to relax her a little. She said, hoping her nerves didn't show.
Actually, I was looking for you. I was thinking maybe I could stay with you for a while, if you don't mind.
He grinned and tilted his head to the side.
You do what you want, don't you?
He said.
You know, the right thing to do is call up your mother and discuss this with her. I gather by the early hour she doesn't know you're here.
No, Charlie said. No, we can't tell Kit. Not yet. I need to get away from her. Look, I know what happened. I know she took me from you before I was born.
She kicked a cake of dried mud off the hubcap.
I could just kill her for it.
Ah, he said. I hoped we could discuss it all together, but it's a touchy topic with your mama.
His tone didn't quite match his words, like he was thinking of something else as he spoke.
I know, she said. I tried to talk to her about it and she shut it down.
He was quiet, long enough that she was about to say something just to break the silence.
Looky here,
he finally said.
How about this? Let's get out of here. We'll go do something just for fun. In a few hours, we'll call up your mama so she doesn't worry her head off, and then we'll make a plan. All of us. Together.
The thought of talking to Kit right now made Charlie sick to her stomach. But she liked the sound of hanging out with Manny for the day. He swung open the car door for her to get in.
Hey, I just want to get some of my things from upstairs, Charlie said.
Manny seemed to tense at this.
Why don't we shove off? Kit could be back any minute, don't you think?
He wasn't wrong, but she wanted her shit.
Won't be a minute.
As she walked up the sway-backed steps to the front door, Charlie brushed down the hairs on the back of her neck. Inside, she detected a dank smell, not of home. An armadillo, perhaps, had burrowed and died under the baseboards. She found her muddy boots where she'd last kicked them off by the stairs. She went around back to the laundry shed and found her favorite jeans in a pile by the washer. There was a wet load in there, so, out of some rote courtesy, she gathered the clean clothes to put in the dryer. In the stiff tangle, she noticed something odd. An article of clothing she didn't recognize. A miniskirt. She shook it out, and with it a skimpy top. A manner of dress that had no business being in this house.
Kit would never wear garbage like this, Charlie thought.
Unless she had completely lost her mind. It couldn't be her mom's. But if it was, all the more reason for her to get the fuck out of whatever nervous breakdown was about to happen. Still, Charlie found it difficult to leave the house, as if it might be the last time she would see it in a long while. She brushed her teeth and scrubbed her pits, flopped down on her bed, and stared out the faded chintz curtains she'd looked at every day of her life. Of course she'd be back. She could come home whenever she liked. Manny issued a short toot from the car horn outside. She went downstairs and locked up. Then, as she left the house, she slammed the old screen door behind her, a gesture that made leaving feel more ordinary. As she approached the car, she noticed there was something different about Manny today. He was beginning to look like a dad. A little concerned and tired around the eyes. His shirt misbuttoned and collar half up like he hadn't bothered to look in the mirror this morning. It was sweet. Why did Kit have to be so hard to love when Manny had shown her it could be so easy? She felt wicked for choosing him. But right now, she was sick of the struggle, sick of being tough and working so hard to matter. Maybe some time apart would do everyone good. Chapter 36. Kit could feel it before she saw it. The figure-eight motion of her hips on a galloping horse, perfectly in sync. Then, a ditch ahead of her, so deep she couldn't see the bottom, so wide there was no way around. She tensed and lost her seat, felt the horse stutter step and slow beneath her while her body kept hurtling forward. She flailed and wrapped her arms around the horse's neck. But as the full force of her weight flew past him, she felt the neck snap in her hands and turn to mush. She began to cry and tried in vain to put him together, fix what she had done. Then his hoof became a claw, and as it moved toward her, she felt relieved that it was alive, and maybe everything would be okay. When the claw plunged into her abdomen and pulled out a mess of her innards, it left a hole clean through the back of her. She felt tremendous pain and startled, gasping, awake. She could tell from the cold and the quiet at her side that Charlie was gone, but reached out for her nonetheless. The gun was missing too. She shook Doc violently. "She's gone," she said, her voice tight with panic. Doc's face looked dead in the violet pre-dawn light.
"What you going on about, babe?"
she said drowsily, the shit smell of her dry mouth hitting Kit's nostrils. Doc fumbled for the pull on her lamp and with a click filled the room with amber light. Kit started to turn over the room. She crouched and looked under the bed, not sure what she was looking for. "Charlie's gone," she said. "She left in the night. Maybe she just went home, but I have a bad feeling about it." She hesitated to voice the suspicion out loud.
"I think she went to find Manny, her father."
Doc swung her legs and felt for her slippers, still trying to understand.
"She what now? Manny who?"
"I'm sorry, I didn't want to say before. Charlie's father got out of prison and came here to meet her, and now I think she's run away, or else he's come and taken her."
"Son of a bitch."
Doc wiggled out of bed and pulled overalls over her nightshirt.
"There was a rumor going around. Never paid it any mind. Is he the handsome devil?"
Kit could scream for how tedious it was to explain things now.
"I don't have time to talk this through, man. We gotta go," she said.
"Okay, but how come you so sure?" Doc said.
Kit suddenly felt ashamed and afraid and had to look away.
"I think it was him that killed Warbucks."
Doc bit down on her cheek, her green eyes filling with tears. Kit had no time for apologies.
"You search the clinic and the stables," she said.
"What about the trailer park?" Doc offered. "Maybe she's hanging out with Dirk?"
It could be worth ruling out, but Kit didn't think Mrs. Durkin would abide another visit from her.
"You go," Kit said.
She tugged her boots half on and stamped her feet.
"I'm going home."
In four long strides, she was downstairs and, seconds later, speeding down the road. She lost minutes at a time, her trip elliptical moments between stretches of black. As she pulled up to the house, she thought she saw Charlie through the window, but it was just a curtain flicking in the wind. She rushed up the stairs and found the front door locked. In a panic, she pounded the door.
"Charlie, open up!"
Had she been the one to lock up? She couldn't remember, didn't know if it mattered or not. She ran back to the truck to grab the keys and let herself in. Again, she called her daughter's name, not knowing whether she would find her dead or alive or not at all. She went upstairs and paused in front of Charlie's room. At first, she was afraid to go in, could only listen through the crack. The house was mum. She towed open the door to a crushing emptiness. The room, the house, her heart. There was only Charlie's bed, unmade, as usual, and the very few things she had kept around her, some books, a table, and chair. In her closet, a few empty hangers, a lone sock, and a Mad magazine folded up in the middle. What she would have given for a smart-ass note on the kitchen table. On her way down the stairs, she saw the dresser underneath the family photo wall and remembered the sheet of pictures from Charlie's school. A photo of Charlie might come in handy, in case they had left town. She pulled the bent grid of photos, 8 smiling Charlies, from the dresser and pressed them to her face. Her breath came quickly now, a sign of fresh panic. It felt like there was a cage around her lungs preventing her from taking a full breath. "Stay calm, stay calm. If you want to find her, you have to stay calm." She sat down next to the dresser, folded forward, and let her feelings slide out the soles of her feet and through the floorboards until she felt nothing but a low-frequency hum. Tears ran down her cheeks, and her breath returned. Then she remembered what Manny had told her when he first arrived. He'd been staying at a motel off the interstate, 5 miles away. What the hell was it called? There were a handful of places on that stretch, and she would check them all if she had to. But only one seemed decent enough for Manny. She folded the photos and tucked them into her front pocket. Then she left without bothering to close the front door, without noticing how her own bed had been carefully made. Chapter 37. Manny had to rush to finish before the sun came up, quickly washing his hands in lake water to replace the smell of her with the funk of algae and fish. He was pleased with his work. Some light biblical symbolism, nothing too heavy-handed. And he'd been gentle with Sandy, even kissed her before he left, a chaste peck on the cheek in case her spirit was looking on. How long before someone found her? If only he could linger and catch the look on their face. A part of him wished Charlie would wander out of her sleep and find him at work. How would she react to his little project? Would it be instant horror? Or perhaps a flash of curiosity, even intrigue? It would be a harsh but swift way to know if she had the mettle to join him. When he got back to the car, Charlie was still asleep in the passenger seat. He decided not to wake her until he had cleared the area, so he left the door slightly ajar and coasted as far as it would go down the slope before starting the engine. Charlie rubbed her eyes as they jittered over the uneven gravel. "Where are we?" she said, looking around. Manny let out a breath, thrilled at how narrowly he had escaped discovery.
"About to head out," he said. "Just had to make a little pit stop."
He wondered if she was groggy enough to let it slip past. The strange location, the sweat and stink about him. She tipped her head against the headrest and stared off at the horizon, so he drove on. 20 minutes or so passed before she spoke again.
"I'm thirsty," she said.
She smacked and frowned slightly, as though she tasted something foul.
"Let's make a little more headway before we stop," he said. "I know a place on the way."
Charlie rolled her head over toward him.
"On the way where?"
She looked curious, he thought, but not suspicious.
"On the way to the best day of your life," he said, and winked.
She snorted a little and rolled her head back toward the window, grinning.
"Yeehaw!"
"There's something you need to know," he said, his tone somber. "You'll be hearing about it in town. Just heard it myself at the gas station while you were asleep."
Charlie yawned and stretched her long arms and pressed them against the ceiling.
"Oh, yeah?"
"A girl in town was killed last night."
She looked at him fast.
"What girl?"
There was alarm in her eyes, a pulse at her throat.
"No one knows yet," he said, "but they tell me it was monstrous."
Oh my God, she said, and slumped back into her seat.
Damn. What else did they say? Was she a little kid or?
They didn't say. Just a girl, strangled to death.
Charlie's hand went to her neck. She shook her head, anxious.
We should go back, don't you think? It feels wrong to go out at a time like this.
Hell no, he said. That's exactly why we should get out of Dodge. I'm keeping you close until they catch him. Or her.
Chapter 38. An electronic cow mooed as Kit opened the door to the reception office of the Big Sky Motel. In the dark and dusty space, the smell of microwaved popcorn and canine flatulence was so thick she had to breathe through her mouth. The managers had the same salt and pepper hair cut short, same soft cookie shape with thick necks and sloped shoulders. They stood side by side, so close they looked connected at the arms. The woman's main distinction was a heavily made-up face, with peacock shadow swiped over her lids and coral gloss on her lips. A balding geriatric poodle on a dingy cushion wheezed in its sleep.
Welcome to the Big Sky Motel, she said in a monotone.
Between them sat a nameplate, which read, Bert and Mabel Schulweiser, owners.
Hi there, I need some help, Kit said. Either of you seen a Manny Romero?
Her voice was dry around his name. They stared at her, still as a painting. For once, she wished she were more of a people person. Manny, she thought, darkly, would have these two eating out of his hand.
I'm looking for a missing person. I think she's been kidnapped.
Mabel shifted slightly away from Bert and pouted her lips out as she considered this request.
Missing person, eh?
She asked, betraying her curiosity. Her painted eyebrows pushed toward her scalp. She elbowed Bert.
Did you hear that, Bertie? A kidnapping.
Bert indulged no one with a response. Kit unfolded the sheet of Charlie's school pictures and pushed it across the counter.
Ever seen this girl?
Bert kept his eyes on Kit. Mabel lifted the glasses hanging around her neck and inspected the photos.
No, I don't believe I have. Is she the kidnapped girl?
Kit bristled at Charlie being talked about, even though she knew she needed these people's help.
Can I just look at your registry for a second?
Mabel glanced at her husband, who had not varied his position in the slightest.
No'm, he said. Those records is private.
Mabel looked around the room as if searching for a way to help, keep her hands in the intrigue. Kit knew if there was a way in, it would be through Mabel.
Curious if y'all had any drifters coming through, Kit said. Maybe someone didn't seem quite right.
Ma'am, we're a roadside motel, Mabel said. All of them are drifters. No one seems quite right.
Ever see a guy come in here with bright blue eyes, tall?
Mabel clapped her hands together and looked like she had just won something.
Oh, yes, the handsome fella. Oh, he was.
Bert hissed a reproach, stepped in front of his wife, and crossed his arms.
We don't know nothing, and if we did, we wouldn't tell you without a signed warrant.
His voice was surprisingly deep. Mabel mashed her sticky lips together and squinted, as if it pained her not to divulge what she knew.
Look, it's my daughter, Kit said, pissed as hell and ready to drag him outside by the scruff.
We ain't seen her,
Bert said, and set his shotgun on the counter. Mabel let herself come around the desk and handed Kit a pen and paper.
Will you leave a number in case we do?
Angry tears came as Kit scribbled her phone number, not that she'd be home to answer a call. She blew out the reception door and tucked around the corner until she was sure the owners weren't watching her. Then she went to the long train of rooms and pressed her ear to the first of 12 doors, straining for a voice, some sound of people stirring. At each room, she listened and tried to see between the curtains, most of which were drawn shut. Inside one, a woman with curly red hair lay sleeping under a pile of sheets. In another, a man sat on the edge of the bed in an undershirt, drinking from a can and smoking a butt. When she got to the 11th room, she saw on the ground in front of the door a smudge of yellow. She knelt down and dragged her finger through the crystalline powder and shards of yellow candy. It looked like Manny's favorite lemon drops crushed underfoot. She licked her finger. Intensely sour and sweet. Kit hurled herself against the door 3 times until she felt the frame begin to splinter, then kicked as hard as she could and stumbled into the dark, cold room. She spun around, disoriented and unarmed. It smelled of him, not fresh, but it was there. Lemon and the unnameable scent that was just Manny. The room was neat the way he liked it. Hospital corners on the bed and windows polished to a sheen. She went to the bathroom, opened the closet. There were no clothes or toiletries, and no sign of Charlie. He'd checked out. As her body shook with wasted adrenaline, her mind filled with unwanted images of Charlie, gasping against the weight of those hands. Her thin arms and legs flailing until they fell around her. She began to feel dizzy and her chest knotted. She sucked at a full breath, but her airway had shut, as if it were she who was being strangled. She staggered toward the door and opened it, and in the expanse, she was able to inhale. She could not abide this helpless feeling, like her hands were tied to her feet. What was she supposed to do? She couldn't do this alone. Even with Doc on the hunt, it wasn't enough. She needed more bodies looking for Charlie. Kit had never been inside the police station, never wanted to. The law, for her, had retained its repellent charge after all these years, and she was conditioned to keep a safe distance. Today, she pulled open the heavy glass door and found Caleb sleeping at his desk like a kid in school. The other officers she knew of, Jackson, Alvarez, and the old-timer whose name she forgot, were either out on a call or getting ready to start a shift. She cleared her throat. Caleb slept on, and she could smell the bourbon in his sweat. She brought her hand down on the table like a mallet. He startled, wiped the spittle from his cheek.
"Oh, hi there," he said.
He looked embarrassed and smiled up at her, but the smile was quickly replaced with a different look, like he'd remembered something sad and went cool. He stood up, tucked in his shirt, and cleared the sleep from his throat.
"What can I do for you?"
he asked more formally. All the momentum she'd sailed in on just dropped away, and she found it difficult to speak. She stood there on the edge of asking, as if gathering courage to step in an icy river.
"I need your help,"
she said, her voice dusty and dry. The sound of the word help, a plea, opened a tender place, as if the act of asking itself intensified her need.
"I can't find—"
Her throat tightened, and she had to wrestle it open before she could finish.
"My daughter."
Concern appeared between his upturned brows, then washed away.
"When was the last time you saw her?"
he asked. He seemed bruised and aloof in the way he wouldn't make eye contact, the downbeat in his voice. The part of her that had grown to care for him was curious about what was making him act this way.
"Last night, when we went to bed," she said. That's really not long enough for us to start worrying yet, he said, again, so removed. We can't declare her a missing person until it's been 24 hours. Then we can send out an alert and organize a search party. Give it some more time. I'm sure it's fine.
She's in trouble. I just know it. You have to do something, she said, her breath shortening. Please.
Kit's plea was interrupted by the sound of a horn honking as a pickup parked astride the station's entrance ramp. Judd Pruitt tumbled out and burst inside, all raspy and out of breath.
I need to make a report or something, he said. There's a body, a dead one.
Caleb left Kit and waved his hands out in front of him.
No need to get all worked up, Judd, Caleb said. You know you can call the county to pick it up. Is it oversized? Livestock?
No.
The man was too flustered to talk. Caleb looked around and whispered,
Is it a cattle mutilation?
Judd's face reddened, the veins on his temples bulging.
Man, it's a person,
he said, and wrung his hat like a wet rag.
It's a girl! Lord Jesus, it's a human being!
Caleb went still. Kit's stomach flipped and her mouth went dry. She charged Judd and got in his face.
What do you mean? Who is it? Was it Charlie?
All of her senses were clogged up, like her head had been dipped in wax. She saw flashes of Charlie shot up with bullets, face down in a bathtub, smothered under a pillow. Judd hunkered like he was about to be hit.
No, ma'am, I don't believe so.
What do you mean? How do you know?
She had him against the door by now.
How can you be so sure?
Judd flinched and talked away from her.
Charlie's just a slight little thing, right?
She's 5'4", 105 pounds, hair black, eyes brown.
This was a full-body person, Judd said.
His hands cupped out as if holding something soft and round.
Are you sure?
She shrieked, and he nodded furiously. She let go of Judd's shirt and nearly wept with relief. Her breath returned.
It's not her, she whispered. Okay there, Caleb said, pushing his way between the two to give Judd some air. That's good. Glad we could sort that out. Now, Judd, I need to get a full statement from you. Let's sit down here, he said,
and led the man over to a chair next to his desk. Caleb poured him a cup of water and pulled out the padded rolling chair for him. Kit leaned against a wall for support, then slid down and held her shins. She couldn't be sure Charlie was safe, but perhaps she was not dead.
Here, Caleb said to Judd. Have a cookie.
He opened a plastic tub of ginger snaps, took two for himself, and handed the rest to Pruitt. He folded back the top pages of a yellow notepad and wrote the date in the upper margin.
Tell me everything and take it slow.
Judd ate a cookie, dribbling crumbs all over the hump of his belly, then drank the water noisily.
Now, before I get into it, you have to understand. I've been trespassing on Arlo Skinner's property to go fishing for 16 years, and I ain't about to stop, so...
He looked to Caleb for some assurance that his fishing would not be affected.
Fine, okay, get on with it, Caleb said.
I will, but just so you know, he's got a lake full of fish and no one controlling its numbers. They'd eat themselves alive if I didn't come and thin them out.
Got it, Caleb said, losing his patience. Loud and clear.
Well, I mention it because from time to time, there'd be carcasses washed up and rotting on the edges of the lake, so I didn't take note of the stench other than it was more pungent than usual.
He ate another cookie, washed it down.
It wasn't until I had about 60 pounds of angry fish around my ankles that I noticed something yonder sticking out of the manger. A gray foot, kind of slender.
I was thinking maybe it was a doe or a coyote crawled in the manger to eat and got trapped. But I got this feeling right in my gut that told me it wasn't any such thing. Too much flesh upon it. I paddled ashore and banked the boat in the mud. I didn't want to look, but I went ahead toward the manger, every step wishing I could turn back and forget I saw anything. When I got high enough on the hill, I saw the rest of her. She was messed up, man.
He started to cry and took another minute with a tissue, pinching the tears from his eyes.
Maybe I should have gone to her, but all I could do was run.
Kit grew heavy as she heard the details of Judd's story. She had thought the death would be accidental, natural causes perhaps. A heart attack in an empty field. But this was malice. It was wicked. She gathered herself off the floor and interrupted the interview.
Hey, she said. I need an answer. We're wasting time.
Caleb looked irritated.
I'll send out some failers, but that's the best I can do at this point, he said,
hands open as if to show they were empty, helpless.
Look, I mean, it's not the first time she's run off, right?
Kit's eyes widened, then narrowed, face flushed.
Look, this girl's dead, she said. You can't save her now, but Charlie's alive. You have to help her.
Caleb looked away and shook his head.
I have to see about this body. It can't wait. I'm sorry.
Her shoulder and elbow dipped back, like she was winding up to punch him. But then all the color and emotion drained from her face and her arms went limp. Nothing she could do to him would bring Charlie back. Again, she felt a void, as if she had been cored. As Kit drove away from the station, everything behind her turned to black. All this time, fending for herself. And the one time she needed help from the guy whose job was to help people, he said no. This was exactly why she had never opened up or told anyone about Manny or any of it, because she was rightly convinced that no one would listen. She could only press on. She sped over to Doc's and pushed down the hope that Charlie would be standing there when she threw open the door. Before she was out of the truck, Doc had run out to greet her.
Just got off the phone there, Doc said, all out of breath. A girl's dead.
I heard, Kit said.
Did they say who?
She was hanging on to what Judd had said, that the dead girl wasn't Charlie. Doc caught her look and shook her head and waved her hands like she was clearing away cobwebs.
Don't you go there, Shaw. It's not your Charlie. Not a chance.
Listen, there's a town meeting at Friends of Jesus in a half hour, Doc said, and slapped the hood of Kit's truck.
For now, we keep looking. We stick together, okay? And then we stop by the church, see who knows what.
Chapter 39. When Kit and Doc arrived at Friends of Jesus, the sun stretched long and low and lit up the church like fire. Doc went for the door, but Kit held her back.
Wait, Doc, I don't want to go in there yet, she said. Let's just listen for a minute.
She rested her arms on the sill of a small stained glass window of a dove holding an olive branch against a blue sky. The window was open wide to let in the late afternoon air. Inside, Pastor Tom walked up and down the aisle, shushing the anxious crowd that was gathered there until he stood behind the pulpit and waved his hands about his head.
Quiet! Everybody hush!
The citizens of Pecan Hollow settled into their seats, finished their sentences, and turned toward the front.
I have called everyone here today to address what has happened. To discuss the death of one of our girls. We've just learned they were able to identify the body as Miss Sandy Blanchette.
He paused as people let out cries, some of horror, some of relief.
and pray her soul makes its way to God.
He smoothed a damp strand away from his temple.
Sandy. Kit held her heart as if to slow its beating.
Doc crossed herself and kissed her amulet. There was a frenzy of concern from the crowd. Vernon Brewster, an old cattle rancher, stood up and set his hat on the pew. A palsy rattled his hands, which he then clasped behind his back.
What was the nature of the crime?
Pastor Tom shuddered.
The police are not discussing details, he said, but I am told it was a most disturbing scene.
There were gasps and then a sober pause as the information sank in.
I mean this in the best way possible, said Beulah Baker, lifting a finger. And I'm not saying she deserved it, but I think Sandy lived in a world of sin, and you know...
Oh, shut up, Beulah, said Darrell Chapman. You're a sinner like the worst of us. You're a flirt and a gossip. Why don't you just leave that poor girl alone?
Beulah gaped dramatically and tightened the floral kerchief around her neck. Tilly Warner, who was sitting behind Beulah, lay a supportive hand on her shoulder.
Here comes my two cents. I never did like the way that Kit Walker came into town all those years ago, all stealthy and whatnot, and just squatted at old Miss Eleanor's, God rest her soul. I didn't like it one bit. And then, what was it? Just a few months later, Eleanor winds up dead?
Pastor Tom held up a hand of moderation. Now, Tilly, you know Eleanor had heart troubles. Coroner confirmed it was heart failure.
Tilly closed her eyes and set her face like she wasn't changing her mind.
I'm just saying is all. What are the police doing about it? What am I supposed to do with my kids?
Asked Gail Peters, who had a child on each knee and one in a stroller to her right.
I spoke to Officer Neighbors just now. He's enforcing a curfew of 9 p.m. Anyone out after that will be arrested. Now, this may be a wanderer, but we cannot rule out the possibility that the evildoer, that Satan, is guiding the hand of someone among us, that his pawn is here in town, maybe even here in this room.
The crowd fell silent, and heads turned left and right in tense assessment. Kit felt a thunderclap of panic in her chest as her suspicion grew more certain. Manny had slathered his charm all over the town. He had been running around with Sandy, no doubt stringing her along. He had played nice with the church people, wormed his way in with Charlie. She had to say it out loud or it would make her ill.
Doc, she said softly.
Doc's attention was fixed on the meeting inside. Kit tugged on her arm, and she turned to Kit.
What is it?
She said.
Doc, I think it was Manny. It was him that killed Sandy. It was him that...
She choked on the words that would follow. Doc gathered her up and patted her back, like she could slap out the bad.
Hush now. Don't you go there. Hear me? Don't let that despair come near. We got one thing to do, and it's find your Charlie.
She let Kit go and pointed inside the church.
Now, let's get in there and see what we can learn.
Pastor Tom's voice boomed.
Now, I want everyone to cooperate with the investigation and to report anything suspicious, even if it's someone you know.
Well, I'd feel pretty suspicious of anyone who's not here right now, if you want my opinion, said Glennis Perdue,
who ran a hair salon out of her kitchen. Reflexively, she pulled a cigarette out of its pack and held it to her lips, then stuffed it back and clasped her purse primly. Beulah piped up again.
Let's not forget that Charlie Walker stabbed Lee Prentice in the face like a psycho.
Some nodded. Others stayed silent.
And you know what else I heard? After she did it,
She just laughed and laughed.
Beulah pressed a manicured finger to her lips, as if holding in a dangerous secret.
I hate to say it, but you know, violence begets violence.
Principal Fowler grunted in agreement. Kit pushed away from the window and stalked out across the lawn. Doc followed.
They're not gonna fucking help me, she said, and wrenched a dry branch off the tree overhead. Those bumpkins are pointing the finger at Charlie, and she's the one that needs their help. I'm on my own.
Nom did you. Would you shut up for a minute?
Doc snapped.
It's just talk. It's what they do. I know they're cranky and full of doubt, but they're human beings, and they've got children and families too. And if you talk to them like you're a person and not a wild animal, they might just help you out.
Shit, no, Kit said.
She twisted the smaller twigs off the main branch and pitched them into the field.
We're wasting time. I gotta get back out there.
Let me butter them up then, babe. Maybe they listen to me.
You gotta find out what they know. Could save lots of time if you give them a chance.
Kit went back to the window to listen.
Now, as you know, said Tom, Ms. Blanchette can't afford much in the way of a funeral, so I'm passing around a collection for a casket. We'll have a sign-up sheet in back for pallbearers and flower donations. Anything you can think of to help.
Tom held either side of the pulpit and dropped his head between his arms.
Now, let's pray. Lord, our Father, hear us. Sister Sandy has been taken from this world, and we just ask you take her in kindly and gently and give her a nice spot in heaven. We fear she was in the hands of Satan, O Lord. We beg you to wrest her from his evil grips and carry her soul to you, God. And we just ask you to watch over us now. In your sweet name, O Lord, Christ Jesus, we pray. Amen.
Kit watched the people of the town dig into their pockets and purses and give all they had. The baskets filled quickly and were passed hand over shoulder to the front. Tom took the collection and bowed in thanks. Kit didn't think they were as good at heart as they claimed, but maybe they were good enough. The old wooden door groaned as she pushed her way in, and every head in the church turned to look. She stood there in the aisle, flanked by the souls of Pecan Hollow. She dared not meet their eyes, but swept her gaze above their heads and gathered the courage to speak. A sharp hoot slipped out of the organ. The organist popped up and waved her hands in nervous apology, played a few chords to clear the air, then sat quietly and listened.
"Charlie's missing," Kit said.
No one spoke. Someone coughed. Gail Peters's middle child said,
"What you say, Mama?"
and was quickly shushed. Kit began to lose her nerve and took a step backward. Then Doc appeared beside her.
"Y'all hear her out now,"
Doc said and stepped aside. Kit looked down before she spoke. She couldn't focus with all these eyes.
"My daughter Charlie, you all know her," she said. "I need your help in finding her."
A man with floppy gray hair and a bandana around his neck said,
"When did you see her last, dear?"
"Last time I saw her was about 9 o'clock last night."
She remembered how furious Charlie had been, how she hadn't touched her food, how there was no more snarl in her voice. Now she wondered if she had stopped fighting because she had already decided to leave.
"I think she's with her father," Kit said.
People exchanged whispers. She paused, not quite ready to share this last piece.
"I think Manny took her."
A collection of gasps and words of surprise.
What do you mean? Manny's her father?
Manny who now? He's that looker been hanging around lately.
Oh, Manuel, from Bible study? That's your girl's daddy?
Kit realized she was still holding the branch she had pulled off the tree outside and rubbed the bark with her thumb. Alonzo Martinez, the griddle cook at the diner, cleared his throat.
I don't know if this helps, but, I saw the two of them, Charlie and Sandy, up at the diner the other day. Seemed to me like they were having a tiff. Sandy must have gotten under her skin, 'cause your girl stormed off.
Glennis raised her eyebrows and mouthed the word, motive, to the woman next to her. Kit rushed up to her and brought the stick down right next to her with a crack. Glennis jumped and turned away, her face shriveled up in fear. Doc yanked Kit back by her shirt and sat her down on the dais.
Listen, Charlie didn't do shit, and you know it.
She lit up with an anger so bright she could scarcely see.
You've got to listen to me. I think Manny killed Sandy, and now he has Charlie.
That's ridiculous. I wouldn't. He saved her mama's life.
Maybe if you kept a closer eye on her, you'd know where she was.
If he's her father, he's got a right to be with her, doesn't he?
Quiet,
Tom said, and slammed his palm on the pulpit. Everyone hushed. Then Tom turned to Kit.
Look, Kit, you come to us asking for help. That's fine. Now, we will send up our prayers and keep our eyes peeled for your daughter. But we have a bigger problem here.
How can we even trust your being up front with us?
I'm sorry to say it, but we don't know you from Adam. You don't fear God. You don't fear no one. I've been waiting for you to walk through those doors since the day you set foot in Pecan Hollow. And today you finally came.
He was preaching, and his tone became more folksy as the spirit moved him.
You come in here throwing accusations, stirring up my flock. Your girl Charlie's always run wild. She'll find her way home. And if she is with Mr. Romero, like you're saying, she'll be safe enough. Whatever you got against him, he ain't no killer.
His voice slowed and became grave.
I seen him carry Joe Beth Crabtree from her pew to her car when her hip was bugging her.
Joe Beth nodded from her pew. Pastor Tom continued.
I seen him weep reading scripture. I seen him praying when ain't nobody was looking, 'cause that's the kind of man he is. He's the godly kind. He didn't kill Sandy Blanchette any more than he killed JFK. Ms. Walker,
he said, and pointed toward the door.
You can take your accusations and your violent heathen ways right out of my church and let the good people of Pecan Hollow grieve.
The congregation was nodding and yesing and turning their eyes toward the ceiling. Kit shook her head and covered her ears. She had known they would turn their backs on her. It was worse than if she hadn't asked at all.
Shame on all of you, Doc said. Imagine if it were your child.
Pastor Tom pointed at Doc now.
You too, with your black magic. Out of my church! Out!
Kit prickled all over. She stalked down the aisle, fuming, and just before leaving, raised her branch high and smashed the colored glass window.